Welcome, everybody. This is the first episode of Elmtown. This is a podcast about Elm and its uses and the people who are using it and the community around it. I'm Murphy Randall. I have here with me Matthew Griffith and Jessitron. Jess, do you want to say your real name, too?
Yeah, my real name is Jessica Kerr, but I really like my Twitter handle, Jessitron, because it's a unique ID.
Good. Very good. And it's guaranteed unique because Twitter says so.
Right.
Yep, yep. Well, let's go through. Jess, why don't you introduce, at the first section here, I want everybody to kind of introduce a little bit about their background, where they're from, what they're doing, and how they're employing Elm right now. So let's start with Jess, and then after Jess, let's move on to Matt, and then I can follow up with my own little story.
Sure. Okay, so I've been a professional developer for 17 years now. C, Java, Scala, Clojure. Now I'm working in Ruby at work. And Elm is just for fun. So I speak at a lot of conferences, and I explore a lot of languages. I've given talks at conferences about Clojure, Scala, Java, JavaScript, except really I talked about Elm, and Elixir, and I'm pretty sure there's a couple more in there. And all of the languages that I've used and explored, F#. Elm is the one that I keep coming back to and actually really wanting to dig into because it has the type system that I love from Scala, and it has like the there's one way to do it that I love from Clojure, and it has the friendly error messages that Elixir is the closest, but really nobody else has that. I love it because I can come to Elm after like working in other languages all day, and when I mess something up, it's nice to me. So it's like a friendly secondary language. So I use Elm by choice. I don't use it at work. And so far, I haven't like built anything really interesting because I keep getting into like exploring the language and how we could do this. And well, it's side projects, so I just want to write the same one over and over and explore different programming techniques.
Well, I mean, there's definitely space for that. Isn't that called academia in a lot of places?
Hey, it's called research, and We all do it, whether we admit it or not.
It's absolutely true.
Yeah, yeah. So I gave a talk at ElmConf.
That wasn't meant to be a bad jab toward anyone. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jen. Sorry.
Oh, that's true. I mean, yeah.
It's hilarious because I work at Cornell Tech, so which is
and
academia.
Also, I love academics. I'm trying to be one myself. So maybe that was just a little bit of like teasing because I want to be
No,
that,
I totally know? Get it. It's great. Okay.
Sorry, Jess. Totally derailed you. Why don't you continue?
That's fine. I gave a talk at ElmConf the other day about using editors from Atomist to mold, to generate and then change the Elm code like automatically. Kind of like refactoring, except outside of any tool, it's independent. It just changes your files or makes a pull request. And also it's like at a higher level. So I'm excited about automating working with Elm at the architecture level, not just the language syntax, but at the Elm architecture level to like conceive and express things about the code at a higher level. And Elm is so perfect for this. So that's what I'm excited about lately.
That's awesome. And I'm going to have 1,000 questions for you in the next section about
Sweet.
Atomist. So get those
Your talk
answers
was
ready.
Yay.
So good. Yeah, I mean, that was genuinely one of the few talks that I was just wowed and amazed.
Murphy, and, you did that talk with the tweets, right?
Yes, it was fun, but
that
it wasn't
was so
at all
fun.
Useful.
It was good. I was highly entertained.
Thank you. That was my goal. I was hoping that that would be the thing. And I'll talk about that probably a little bit after Matt introduces himself and his situation.
Yeah. So I'm Matthew Griffith, and I've been doing programming for, I guess 10 years now. Like doing web stuff. Kind of started in Perl and migrated to Python, and then, you know, since I've started programming, I had this like passion of like I want to visualize music. And I've re-implemented that in like basically every language that I know, and you know, what does it mean or whatever, and you know, and that kind of like led me from doing dynamic languages to Haskell, actually, which is interesting, but just realizing that, you know, with a project that has a sufficient complexity, where you're dealing with a lot of these like really nuanced kind of ideas and you want to be very precise, having a type system is really important. And then from Haskell and writing, I actually wrote a guitar tablature parser. So guitar tablature is like, it's like sheet music, but it's not sheet music. It actually describes where to put your fingers on the guitar. And it's just a text file. And humans write these, so they're like all over the internet. I'm like, oh man, well, if I could parse those and like get the data, that would just be really cool because it's a massive amount of data and probably like 80% of it is like totally incorrect. But if you had somewhere to start, that'd be very interesting. So that's what got me into like functional languages, is trying to wrangle that. And
so is that still around? That sounds really neat.
It's around. It's actually a part of a project that I hope to launch as a company.
Oh, cool.
You know, with the idea of like how do guitarists like visualize music, or how do they think about music? Because they tend to not think about it like in sheet music. I think piano players think about sheet music a lot more naturally, but it's actually like, I think, hard for guitars. But then I kind of progressed and I was like, okay, well, I have this problem and I need to like I need to not only have the data, but I need to like visualize stuff. And played around, you know, I've been using JavaScript forever and you know, playing around with new stuff like React and whatever, and I just ran into that same problem where it's like this visualization's like complicated with nuances, and you know, I keep, you know, you got to a certain point in the project where it's like I felt like I was just slowing myself down, and then I'm like, okay, well, I gotta do a similar thing that I did on the back end, but by like moving to a stronger type system, and like Elm kind of came along, and I jumped in there. I was like, oh wow, okay, like I like this almost even more than Haskell, just because the actual syntax is like, I mean, it's more constricted, but that actually turns out to be make it like incredibly readable and incredibly accessible, which I value very, very highly. And that actually led me to animation, because like if you want to visualize stuff, you want to animate it. And that led me to create the Elm style animation library and actually give a talk about it at ElmConf. And then, you know, totally kind of got sidetracked and really focused on that for a long time. And it was incredibly rewarding, and I think it's really interesting. But yeah, that's kind of my journey, like how I got here. I currently work at Cornell Tech. So Cornell Tech is related to Cornell, but specifically a graduate school for technology students, with the idea that they graduate and then they kind of launch a company, or they, you know, it's really kind of almost like an academic incubator is how I think about it. So I'm a developer in residence there, which means that I can like talk to the students, talk about like technology choices, help faculty with research, and I get to write open source software, which
sounds like the best job ever.
It's pretty amazing. What I like generally use Elm for these days when I'm not writing, you know, maybe libraries in Elm that to be used by other Elm people, is we do a lot of like rapid prototyping, obviously. And I'm fascinated with the idea of rapid prototyping that is not only rapid, but not, it doesn't break, right? Or like captures what
rapid solid prototyping.
Yeah. Like it's like, oh yeah, now we can just, you know, I mean, maybe we'll spruce up the design a little bit, but it's totally functional and this is what we would want to ship. Like that property is really powerful.
If we could have the speed of prototyping, except it would just be rapid development.
Yeah. It's like not rapid prototyping, but like rapid development. Cause that's, you know, yeah. So like we're doing
I find that that's one of the coolest things about Elm is that the prototypes can often turn into something usable because the refactoring story is so good, because you're not stuck going, okay, well, let me start over again now because I made a mess with this with this prototype and right. Now I can't actually use it.
Right. Yeah, I think one of the things that that I definitely kind of encountered, this is actually probably my biggest well, I don't want to say biggest because there were so many really awesome things about ElmConf, but so I have this, you know, music visualization thing that I'm working on, and Richard's talk on like making impossible states impossible, right, which I thought was just fantastic. But it opened up my eyes, and this is like a lesson that I have to like continuously relearn is like get your data structure right. And if you do that, then like your code just like shrinks and gets really nice and small.
Yeah, that's the most important.
And so like I think the day after I heard that talk, and I was like thinking, I'm like, oh man, like the like zip list he was talking about, like that's exactly why my current code is super complicated, is because I'm not using that.
That was a fantastic talk. Yeah. And if you dear listener have not seen that talk, you should go see it. You should go watch it because it's very educational. Hey, Jess, I forgot to ask you to mention where you work, if you wouldn't mind.
Oh, that's important. Well, it's important in the sense that, like, so I work at Stripe, and they're in San Francisco, and I work remotely from St. Louis. And I really like it, and we're always hiring. So that's why it's important. I don't get to do Elm at Stripe. We do mostly Ruby, Scala, and Go. And of course, JavaScript. Everyone does JavaScript. And I get to work in infrastructure and write software that supports running software, which is fabulous.
Very cool. And you are also consulting for Atomist, is that correct?
No, I'm an advisor.
Oh.
So it's like I don't get paid, but I do have like some incentive to help them succeed. But really, I'm an advisor because I desperately want them to succeed because I want these tools.
That makes sense. Oh, that makes a lot of sense. All right, well, so I'll introduce myself a little bit. So interesting, very, very cool stories, you two. Thanks for sharing those things. I come from a background in animation, actually, Matt.
What?
At a very early age, I started getting into animation software, and I noodled around with it all the time. And then eventually in college, got into the animation program at BYU, and that's in Utah. Which is a pretty well-known animation program. And the funny thing was, I didn't get in because I can draw. I got in because I could noodle around with software. And that was my domain expertise, was animation software and producing things with that, though I didn't really like to animate myself. I wouldn't have really counted myself as an artist. So what I ended up doing there was learning to program. And I had done a little bit of programming for the years before college and usually just decided, you know, I'll never be a programmer. It's way too hard. So instead of investing in programming and classes from the beginning of college, I went ahead and did animation. And I got to work at Pixar for a while, which was really cool. And there we did Python. And that really awakened my hunger for programming and software engineering as a profession and not just as a tool to get animation done. So I came back, finished up school, and then at the end of school, I ended up getting a job as a full-time web developer doing Python and JavaScript on the front end. And I'm pretty young as far as people who have been employed in the industry goes. I think that was only a little over 3 years ago that I got that job. And I learned very quickly because it was at a small startup and one of the other team member that I had who was working with me left to go back to his other company. And so all of a sudden, instead of being just the junior helper, all of it was on me. And so I had to learn quickly. So that was a really cool learning experience. And from there, I went on to another company where I got to have kind of one quarter of the say in the development of a new large-scale enterprise app for higher education. And at that point, I was doing architectural design without really having the experience to do it. So I made some bad mistakes, some things that were difficult to recover from. And part of the reason they were difficult to recover from was because we were fully invested in JavaScript tools early on. So not only was I experimenting with architectural things that were kind of new patterns to me and seemed to make sense, but maybe weren't the best design, but also we were heavily invested in React, ES6, Webpack, JavaScript, Flow. We were using like all the new tools, also Koa as a framework, and RethinkDB on the back end, all of these unproven, not unproven necessarily, but relatively young technologies together. And we it took a lot of work to try to keep those things together. So at that point, after a year and a half of working on that project, I ended up wanting to do something other than enterprise software. And so I ended up where I am currently right now, at a company called Day One. We make a journaling app for the iPhone and Mac, and I'm making the web client. And it's a very small company, and I'm the one doing the web stuff. And it's a much slower pace than where I was before. So I get to take a little more time to kind of plan things out and figure out what's going to be the right pattern. And when I got here, the other people who are working here, especially the server-side guys, are big proponents of functional programming. So that was a great opportunity. And I really tried my best to make a pragmatic choice about the tech stack we'd move forward with while building the web client. And I had kind of ruled out Elm at that point because I wanted the security of the React ecosystem. But after doing quite a bit of experimenting with PureScript backed by React, and then also Scala.js backed by React, I went to ElmConf and gave a talk there. But wow, I was so blown away by how many people there were at ElmConf, how interested they were, and how accessible Elm as a language is to your general JavaScript developers and not just people who are self-proclaimed functional nerds. Jess is asking in chat how many people were at ElmConf. I think it was between 230 and 250 after talking with the organizers. Yeah, that's like many, many, many more people than I thought would be there and interested. So when I came back, I realized that the ecosystem is pretty solid. The tools are pretty darn good. The type system is amazing. And also, of any language, of any typed language other than maybe TypeScript, I feel like it's the most accessible to any JavaScript developer who is just coming in from no background in languages like this. But I would actually say it's even more accessible than TypeScript, because TypeScript takes a lot of, in my experience at least, TypeScript took a lot of understanding about type systems already to figure out like where I was using it wrong and why I was using it wrong. Where I just feel like staying inside of the Elm world is a much safer place to learn about type systems if you're not already experienced in them.
Really? I wonder. I would like to hear about that from people who haven't used type systems yet.
That's kind of the experience I had, because the best experience I had with type systems were Java and C++ in college, and then I had spent years doing JavaScript and Python, so it was all kind of out of my mind. And I was trying to do Flow and TypeScript, and I was at the point where it was saying like, here, let's write a polymorphic function. And I was like, what's polymorphism again? You know, I had been out of that space
it
for a while.
A frog
and
later.
So
that's what polymorphism is.
Oh, is that going to happen to me? Because I would like to not have that happen.
I would say that Elm has lower barriers to entry than TypeScript, in the sense that I don't have to learn JavaScript.
No, that's interesting.
I think one of the things that like really attracts me to Elm, and it's something like I actually got to talk to Evan about the animation library, and he kind of, like as we were talking about it, he kind of reminded me that, you know, when you're sketching out a library, you have this kind of, this option of not writing any code. But just writing type signatures. And you can actually like cover a huge amount of area by just doing that. You can actually kind of mess with Elm and get it to compile too without writing any code, but having like a good idea of like the grand overview. And something that I think to people who are like from dynamic languages or whatever, it's like, it's so far, you know, it's like in dynamic languages, it's code first, right? But here we get to do types first. And so you have to like turn your brain upside down, but then once you do, you end up with like this ability to really like sketch out what you're doing, and then like have a computer kind of check your logic. And it's not like 100% perfect. Sometimes you write a a type signature of a function, and you know, you realize that there are additional considerations to have later, right? But
But then the compiler helps you.
Yeah, and you have a really good initial sketch, And it's like writing pseudocode, except it still is code, you know, which is fascinating.
It really is a different order of work. So with JavaScript or Ruby or Python, you get used to seeing something happen early. And with Elm or any strongly typed compiled language, you have to get used to thinking about the structure early and later seeing something. And you have to get to the point where, oh, I got a different compile error, feels like progress.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it is.
Well, I think there is this phenomena, and I've kind of gotten away from it just because I've been using Elm and Haskell for a decent period of time now. But like when you're writing your initial, especially your initial stuff, it feels like you're not coding. And I think the reason why is because like in Python, it's like I want a thing to happen. So I write the code that makes that thing happen, and it happens pretty quickly. You know, like in some sort of, you know, basically probably not totally complete, but, you know, you get something. And in functional languages, it's like you do have to, like, think more about, like, okay, how are we going to handle this? You know, like, what are my types? Where are we going? But, like, getting the payoff is, like, delayed, even though there is this, like, really satisfying moment where it's, like, you've been kind of delaying that. But then, like, all the pieces come together, you know, because the compiler has been just leading you to that, that glorious moment when like everything compiles and then everything just works and you're happy, and like you went from feeling like you were like making no progress, maybe not no progress, but feeling like you weren't doing the thing that does the thing, to like being done.
I've actually experienced, this has been an interesting thing I was telling my wife the other day, while using Elm, I tend to reach the end of my task before I'm ready to be done with the task. And then I have this weird emotional moment of like, but I wasn't ready to be done working on that. Like it just finished. The compiler finished. It just works. And then I'm like, well, I guess I can move on.
If I don't have to fix any bugs, then clearly I'm doing something wrong and I just can't see it.
Exactly right. It's kind of strange, but now I'm starting to get used to it so I can move fast. So just to wrap up, what we ended up deciding to do here at day one is give Elm a good run for its money. So I actually am going to be using it in production, I believe, and I'm writing the prototypes right now. So we'll hopefully they'll get deployed and shipped, and we'll be able to have some good success stories in coming weeks and months to talk about here. So let's talk about editors. And Jess, I think we should start by talking about Atomist a bit, because that was a pretty mind-blowing demo you gave at
Atomist.
So why don't you introduce what they are? Because we didn't get to know very much about them as an actual startup, and their webpage is just like a sign up, you know?
Right. Well, conveniently, just last night, the CEO of Atomist, and also like the person who's done the most coding on the editors that I showed, Rod Johnson published a blog post, which we can link in the show notes. And he's talking about the editors and the concepts behind them, and that they're definitely going to open source this.
Ooh.
In the very near future.
How are they going to make money if they're open sourcing the editor concept?
Oh, I probably shouldn't talk about that. I actually do have some idea, but I think that's probably under any. But, how does GitHub make money when they offer free repositories?
Sure.
It's that kind of thing.
Everybody's got to make money somehow.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. But it turns out that it's one thing to like give someone the ability to use your tool for free. And then it's another thing to like provide it with like redundancy and collaboration and privacy and all the things that enterprises need. And there's quite a line there.
Yeah, that's interesting. That makes sense.
Just like GitHub. It's exactly like GitHub.
Okay. Why don't you tell our beloved listeners a little bit just about what you demoed and why we were all blown away about it. I don't even know that I understand a lot of what Atomist does as a whole company, but I just knew about the demos that you showed on screen.
Right. So the first thing that the goal of Atomist is to make development, and specifically development of small services, a lot easier and a lot smoother and a lot less, oh my gosh, who calls this? I don't remember. What do I? Anyway. The first thing that they're releasing is this editor concept, which is, you can think of it as code generation. So there's a lot of templating engines where you can say, okay, I want a project with these parameters, and I've got a template over here that's in like the special templating language, and that's going to generate some code for me. And then you start from that code and you never come back to the template because it's just one and done. But it gives you a starting point. So atomist editors say, wait, why do we need a special templating language for this? The template itself should be a valid project. And the reverse also works. Every working project is a valid template. Wow. And then when you want to change something about it, like I want a different project name. You almost certainly want a different project name. You want it in a different repository. And then you probably want like a different description and maybe a different package name. And those can all be applied as transformations.
So does that happen? I mean, that has to be intelligent, right? So there has to be something that like builds an AST and knows how to do those transformations, right?
There are three different answers to that.
Okay.
At the simplest level, I mean, something like changing the name of the project, I can do that with a regex. And you can write an atomist editor. So writing an atomist editor is like a little set of instructions. There's a DSL for that. It's called RUG. So you can write the little set of instructions and actually just use regex on the files at the simplest level. So I can replace the project name with just that. There's another level of, I mean, regex is great for a search and replace, but as soon as you get a little past that where you want to like convert something to camel case or something like that, it gets harder. Or find something in a child element of the body element of the HTML file or something like that. It gets, so the second level of generic file editing is a microgrammar, which is a BNF form grammar. It's actually Antler. Antler is like a parsing tool that I think it's in Java, where you can define a BNF grammar for your language and then it can parse it. Except you don't want to define a BNF grammar for your whole language. That's a pain, unless you look it up, which is an option. But you can just define a little snippet. Like in one of my editors, I say, okay, there's something that says target, and then there's some space that I want you to insert this thing. And then after that, it says echo compiling when I'm inserting something into my build script. And I can write a tiny grammar for that. And it's not all that different from the regex, except it's more powerful and much more expressive. Thank goodness. Because I love regex, and then I hate them whenever I come back and have to figure someone else's out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So the grammar's like an in-between step of let's understand just a tiny piece of your AST, of your syntax. And then the editor will find the places that match that. And anything that doesn't fit with that syntax, we'll just ignore that, which is sweet. And then there's a third level. In the case of Elm, Rod and I made a parser in Scala Parser Combinator. So we made a custom parser for Elm so that in my editor instructions, I can say things like, with Elm module named blah de blah, with function main, change the body in this way.
Which is amazing.
Yeah, once yeah. So with like some extension code that will be released with the open source editors, I can actually express Elm concepts. I'm thinking about adding another level that is the Elm architecture. Like on top of that, I think it might be worth putting this in Scala. So I could say with Elm program, do this to the update function.
Mm. Well, that sounds really interesting. So when it actually breaks the whole piece of code, all of the code into an AST, and then when you restructure it, it rebuilds it. Is that how it works, or are you doing some kind of a partial reconstruction?
Excellent question, because it's, this will be in the open source. It actually, when it's parsing it, it retains, this is an extension to the parser combinators, it retains the position information in the file and all the padding information. Because initially, it was when it was just parser combinating and then writing it back out, it would lose things like where comments were and things that people had put manually into the file, and that's not okay. We want the editors to work on your file the way you would work on your file, so that you can't tell the difference between a developer did it and Atomist did this. So it actually updates the, like, for instance, if I change the type of the update function, it's actually updating that type in the file in the place where the type is.
Wow.
Just like I do when I open my editor, I look to the update function, I find its type declaration, I click in there, and I type something. That is exactly what the editor is doing.
That sounds like it's some pretty incredible engineering going on.
I'm super excited about it. Yeah, yeah. Agreed.
So that sounds like a fantastic tool, and we're all excited to see that when we can get our hands on it. So let's talk a little bit about actual text editors or IDEs. Mention what we use and why we do that, and then we can talk a little bit about plugins and maybe some of the tools, the tooling that's available for Elm independent of the actual text editor. So Matt, what do you use normally?
Sorry, I had myself muted. So I mean, I go back and forth between Sublime Text and Atom, and I'm kind of caught between the two.
That's interesting. So why are you caught? What's the sticking point?
Well, the thing, and it's funny because I'll spend like 2 months in one and then 2 months in the other. But the most recent experience with Atom, it just has to do with speed, and it's not necessarily, I think, the common, like, I think, complaint with Atom of like, oh, I want to open this like huge file, you know, and not, you know, blow up, which, you know, I mean, I definitely do, but I don't do that very often. I don't have very many files that I'm actually editing like on that size. But what I find is actually that the latency and like just keystrokes, this is just something I noticed, like, and who knows if it was something that was, you know, passing or what happened, but like you want like a certain amount of responsiveness, you know, and it was bugging me.
Yeah, the same things have bothered me too.
Yeah, and then going over to Sublime Text, I'm like, okay, like this is at like the frame rate and the, like, you know, it doesn't like bug me on like a subatomic level. Nope, no pun intended. But yeah, you know, at the same time, like when I was there, like I felt the autocomplete on Atom was at least for Elm was nice. Like I found myself actually using it, which, you know, a decent number of kind of helpful plugins, like it takes a lot to convince me to use something, because like if I fight with it, I want to minimize fighting with it, and I find, you know, on average, any given plugin or module or whatever, I'm probably fighting with it a little bit, and so my like tolerance for adding new plugins is like it's like, you know, I don't do it. So yeah, I mean the main thing I do is it's honestly the Elm format. Like I feel like this is something, and this is totally editor, you know, not specific or whatever, but
which,
like,
is great.
Yeah, fantastic. And it's just like it changed kind of the way I approach coding, and it kind of convinced me. I never really thought of the idea of like an auto formatter, and because it's not really common in like Python and even Haskell or you know, whatever. If it is, you know, I'm just not kind of part of that community, I suppose. But
it
just convinced me.
Typically from Go, I think it.
Right, Go format, right. Which I had heard about, like, conceptually. But I guess I didn't realize, like, there's some, like, deeper benefits than just like, formatting your code. I mean, formatting code is fantastic. But there's also some kind of, like, nudges as to, like, how to handle stuff. And so, for example, like, you know, you're using the pipe operators, right? I think I saw someone call them the pizza operators, you know, pizza left and pizza right. And, you know, when I kind of jumped in here, you know, in Haskell, there's just dollar sign, which is pizza right, I suppose. And right. So it's interesting, like, learning between the two. And I found when I started, because I didn't have a background in like creating pipes, I was using the wrong one to create all my pipes. And actually the first version of the animation library, which was like you create an animation via creating a pipeline, I did it backwards. I used the one that's like not the common one to use, and someone had to like tell me. But what's interesting is Elm format actually formats those two things differently. Like with the you know, the arrow pointing to the right, it gives you this kind of like, you know, let's go through these instructions from top to bottom. And if you point it to the left, it actually kind of like indents it, which is actually like an indication, once you kind of see those two behaviors, of like, it actually changes how you approach, like how you write the code. Because you're like, oh, it's so much nicer when it's just like, you know, a pipe going from top to bottom.
That's really interesting.
And so there's kind of like I don't want to say unspoken, but like rules that you have to like engage the community with to get like why you might pick one way over another way. And Elm format, I think, does some stuff to like kind of nudge you in the right direction without you having to get like, you know, someone on Elm Discuss saying like, well, your code looks kind of bizarre.
Yeah.
That's kind of where
feel free to pipe in anytime, Jess, too. I think this is kind of a free for all conversation. Matt, I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think Elm format is a hugely awesome tool, and I use it as an editing crutch, which maybe isn't a great thing, but it makes my writing Elm code so much faster, because I write it like a lazy person, just write, you know, I all my brackets are all over the place.
I feel like when I'm writing, when I have Elm format, I feel like I'm like the crazy artist who has like a who's like the butler's following behind him, and like the butler sees what he's doing and then just like straightens everything up right behind him, and like, yeah, I really enjoy that feeling.
It makes live coding a lot easier. Someone remarked that in my live coding, I lean on Elm format a lot, because I'll just type crap and hit save, and then it makes it pretty
totally readable. And actually, so that's what's interesting too. I use it as an indicator of whether I'm doing something right or not, kind of like Matt's head. But for me, it's almost like the linter that'll give you errors, you know, as you're typing or right when you save. Because I'll type something out and think, okay, I wonder if I'm doing this right. I'll save, and that's okay. I'll save, and then if it snaps into place and it looks right, then I'm like, okay, I did it right.
Well, it's interesting, because it's almost like a nice linter. It's like, oh, you want to approach it that way. Well, if you did approach it that way, it would look like this. And you're like, oh boy. I don't know if I want it to look like that.
I use Elm format that way too. So in Atom, I hit save, it runs Elm format. Unfortunately, Elm format either works or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, then I need to go to the compiler to find out what the problem is.
If it doesn't, you did something very wrong.
Well, sure, it's not going to compile, and the compiler is going to give me the nice error. It would be nice to incorporate that error into the editor message, rather than just Elm format says no.
Yeah. Yes, and so actually there's a plugin called Linter Elm Make for Atom. I also use Atom for Elm, so I'll throw that in there. Linter Elm Make, which will tell you linter errors, including the compiler errors, but in the case where the Elm format won't run because you have a syntax error that it can't parse, I think you have to like scroll all the way to the top of the file to see what the error is if you have that plugin installed. But that's also an excellent plugin. I use it all the time to speed up my development, and it does a pretty darn good job. I don't know if either of you two have used that one yet.
No, but I'm going to check it out now that you mention it.
Not yet, yeah. Okay. So I just downloaded the IntelliJ plugin for Elm.
Oh, yeah, tell us how it is.
Yeah, the one by Camille Durkiewicz. And it's good. I use IntelliJ regularly at work. I'm used to it for Java and Scala, and I use the refactoring functionality a lot, and I really, really like to be able to click through to see the definition of a method, which is perfect in Elm. It actually is easier in Elm to determine what code is going to execute at a function call, because that's not entirely deterministic in Java and Scala, but it is in Elm. And so I get spoiled by that. I even use IntelliJ for Ruby. It's kind of iffy with Ruby, but it's better than nothing. And now the Elm plugin there's a new one. There's two. Don't use the old one. Use the one by Camille. And it's beautiful. It supports Elm 17. I can click through. I can click on a control click on a function call to get to the function. Oh, nice. It's got a rename refactoring that renames the function in every file that uses it.
Very cool.
Yeah, and it'll even do the auto import thing where if I
oh, that's nice.
Yeah, yeah. So if I use on click and I need the import, I can like Alt Enter. I don't even remember the keystroke because it's instinctual.
I think
but
it's
it'll
Option
just put
Enter.
The import in for me. Ah,
so nice. That's something I really wish that Atom had. So there is a plugin for Atom called Elm Jitsu. And by our dear friend Halo Special, and I never remember his actual name, so I'm not going to say it. But Halo Special made Elm Jitsu, and he just basically dove in, got his hands dirty, and did a bunch of regex work, and put together rudimentary support for some nice autocomplete, but also some basic refactoring. So what you were saying, Jess, you can do the same thing. Command click on something to go to the definition. You can do find usages across the project, and it'll do that semantically, not just with a find all. It'll actually tell which symbol you've imported from which file and find those usages. You can also do a rename that way. It's not perfect by any means, but it has helped me quite a bit as I've learned to use it. So that's a really neat Atom plugin that does some of the things that you're saying that the IntelliJ plugin does.
Cool.
And we should probably also mention, so most of your time are you using Atom, Jess?
So far, yeah, but I think I'm going to switch to IntelliJ.
Okay. And Matt's back and forth between Sublime and Atom. I'm also back and forth between Sublime and Atom, but I'm usually with Atom because I'm pretty picky about beautiful user interface stuff, and Atom's just more flexible that way.
That's a big selling point for me, too.
So unfortunately, we don't have any users of Lighttable in here, or code, VS Code. But the Lighttable plugin, I see it from afar and I drool quite often because Magnus, the author, has done some really incredibly cool stuff, doing his own parsing of Elm to make an AST to give you. You can do like a dependency graph that he renders out with D3 inside the editor. So if you're into Lighttable, certainly check that out because it's an excellent plugin. I just haven't really gotten into using Lighttable. And VS Code, I've heard, is pretty good too, but I haven't looked at that plugin recently. Hopefully, so at ElmConf, there was some discussion about tooling and some discussion about the plans for Elm format. And I got to talk a little bit to Aaron and to Evan about this and see kind of what the plans are. And so I'm not going to like say anything that's going to get me in trouble for making promises, because there are no promises made. But the general idea of where we want to move forward with this is we want to make all of the editor tooling more uniform and more easy to use by building a lot of the tools that people are doing ad hoc right now into Elm format and into the Elm compiler. And so what they're trying to do right now is modify Elm format so that it'll produce an AST that has information that has more information than the Elm compiler has. Because when the Elm compiler builds something, it throws away comments and it throws away stuff it doesn't care about, like white space. So Elm format needs to keep those things in their AST, just like you were saying earlier, Jess, is that if it doesn't keep those in their AST, your code gets completely mangled when it tries to restructure it. And probably I should mention, for those who don't know what an AST is, it's basically just a data representation of your code that's not just a text file. So it's an actual data structure that represents what your code looks like.
Stands for abstract syntax tree.
That's exactly right. Yep. And that can be modified. So that's what's so cool about an AST. It can be read in, since it's just data. It can be transformed in any way that is appropriate and then re-rendered back out into source code. So it's really necessary for plugins to be able to do some of this important stuff. So Elm format is going to try, hopefully going to try to get a good comprehensive AST that it will both export and read in. So you could give a file to Elm format, it would give you back the AST. You could modify the AST, so do some refactoring, right, in some programming language, and then give that AST back to Elm format, and it would render your file back out according to those changes. But then also the AST wants to represent the ability to query for types. So for example, it could then hand a chunk, and hopefully I'm understanding this correctly, it could then hand a chunk to the compiler and say, hey, give me the type information where I'm missing it right here. and then the compiler will hand back, do all the inference, and then hand back and say, oh, this is going to be this type. So that should open the door for all of the editor plugins when they start to use this to be able to do things like selecting a section of code and saying, oh, what's the type here? Or while you're typing, do autocomplete on what the type should be as you're typing it in, which are really nice things that you get if you're using IntelliJ and Scala, for example, some of these older languages. So that's something I'm really looking forward to, but I don't think there's a schedule for that yet. Yeah. That's all I got.
Well, cool.
Anything else on editors from either of you before we finish up? Sounds like no. Let's move on to picks. Let's move on to picks. So I will go first. No, I will go last so that I don't scoop anybody. Let's start with Jess. Jess, do you have any picks for today?
Sure, I can come up with some picks. Well, I will pick Rod's blog. Blah, 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 blah. I will pick Rod's blog post about Atomist. I'll provide a link to that. I also want to pick for Matt. There's a talk at Strange Loop by Chris Ford about representing music in code. He was using Clojure, but it was one of my favorite talks at Strange Loop because it was really about how we can use code to express the elements in the music, the scales that are involved and the rhythms that are involved and the variations that are involved. And you can even, in code, you can express randomness in a way that you totally can't in sheet music. And also he managed to bring it around to talk about cultures and appropriation and other people topics. So Chris Ford's talk from Strange Loop this year was about African polyphony in Clojure, and I'll link to that.
That sounds very awesome. I'm definitely going to check that out.
Cool.
Is that it for you, Jess? Those are all your picks?
I'll have one more pick. The other thing that I'm doing lately is learning to play piano.
Nice.
And yeah, I mean, so many programmers are musicians, and I've never been able to talk about that with them. And I've found that learning an instrument, I'm not only learning about music, I'm learning about how to learn. I've also been reading Kathy Sierra's book, Badass, Making Users Awesome, and it talks about how people learn and how we actually master a skill as opposed to just get to be able to do it with concentration. And I'm able to apply that to the piano and therefore through that learn how to apply those thoughts to learning about code.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's my last pick.
That's great. I have that book on my to-read list also. Matt, why don't you... You know, I didn't actually ask you, Matt. Should I be calling you Matt or is it Matthew?
Oh, either way.
Okay, great. So
I never really landed on that argument.
Why don't you give us some of your picks?
So my picks, so kind of the two things, and I'm going to kind of cheat here because the two picks that I think people should check out if they haven't, they're both from ElmConf, and a lot of the talks were amazing, but I feel that Richard's talk about making impossible states impossible and just how you kind of can focus on types a little bit stronger, it changed how I my priorities in my code, and which I've been writing Elm for a while here, right? So it's really cool to have a talk where it's like, oh man, this is practical. This is super practical, and that's what I want. And then Joel's talk on rolling random Romans, which from the name, you'd be like, what are you talking about? but it was fast.
That was really enjoyable.
It was so good because it was talking, it had this backdrop of the idea is how Roman citizens, ancient Roman citizens, were named. And it's using a system that is very different from modern English or what have you. And it's given that here are all the rules, how do you express this doing random number generation, which you have to approach random number generation very differently in a functional language like Elm than you may be used to in imperative languages. So it's simultaneously an awesome history lesson and like also has some really cool like technical insights. So I love when things are paired like that. But yeah, those would be my two picks.
That is awesome. Thank you for picking those, and I think they were fantastic talks also.
Both of your guys' talks were amazing too. I don't mean to leave you out.
Of course.
And yours, Matt. We all happen to give talks, so that's fantastic. My picks. I think the number one thing I'm going to pick today is a book called, let's see, it's called The Haskell Book. The Haskell Book. I think you can find it by just going to haskellbook.com. We'll put it in the show notes. Haskell Book is a book about Haskell, and it's written in a way that's very approachable, even though it delves into some pretty advanced concepts. And the reason I'm picking that on an Elm show is because Elm is based in a lot of ways on Haskell, and in a lot of ways it's not. But reading that Haskell book and learning about the design decisions behind Haskell and kind of the way it works has given me a very interesting window into Elm and has actually made me more productive in the language, because I can do things I didn't know I could do before just because I understand the kind of the constructs of the language because I was reading the book.
Interesting. So Elm is very, very targeted at people who don't know Haskell. You don't need Haskell to learn Elm, but yet once you love Elm, you could use this book to level up.
Certainly. I think that's a very important thing. I think it's extremely important that Elm is approachable and that it doesn't put up this wall of you must be brilliant to work in this thing. The thing you need to do when you get to Elm first is start working, and because you can just start doing stuff and getting it done. But I highly recommend not staying there. I highly recommend moving forward with understanding and beginning to understand the concepts that Haskell employs, because there's a reason that they were invented, because they're quite useful and they are used in Elm in many ways, just not on the surface. So it can be quite helpful to begin to understand those concepts. And in that same vein or spirit, I'm going to pick a library from Fresh Eyeball called Return. And this employs, so if you want to run out and read about the Return library, just know that the language that's used and the concepts that are talked about are targeted towards someone who is already familiar with some of these things from Haskell. So it might not make immediate sense. And hopefully there'll be some documentation at some point that's targeted toward those who don't get these things. But the point is that Fresh Eyeball makes this abstraction that wraps up the return type from the update function and makes it composable and easily usable. Because right now it's a tuple of model and command, and it can be rather cumbersome to work with those things. But what he's done is made a type that encapsulates that and then provided a bunch of functions for mapping over it. And so it actually makes it so that you can take your return from an update, and instead of having to decompose it and handle both of the parts, composing both the command and the model update and then sticking them back on your parent model, you can actually just map over both and give them functions. Or if you're transforming a model, all of a sudden your model becomes pipeable. You can pipe it through modifications, and it becomes very clean, very easy to understand, where before it was somewhat cumbersome. But that comes with the disclaimer that if you go read the docs, it would be helpful to understand what a monad, at least kind of what a monad does, and what a monoid kind of does. But those things aren't necessary to start using it either. If you just look at the examples, it makes a lot of sense. So that's pick number two. And then I'll follow up Jess's piano pick by also picking the ukulele. I have played guitar on and off over the years, and I went to Hawaii for a work trip earlier this year, and I actually spent real money on a real ukulele, and it has been such a pleasure to have at home to play around with. And
wow. Much and more portable than a piano.
So next Elm podcast is going to be a jam session, I'm assuming?
It's the Elm ukulele, yeah.
Oh, Kevin, you piano. Totally need some ukulele exit music now.
Now, maybe someday I can figure out and compose some. All right, well, unless anyone has some final notes, I think that's it for us.
I'm good. This has been fantastic.
Yeah, thanks, Murphy, for organizing this.
You are so welcome. Thank you for giving your time to join. And thanks to all three of our employers for giving us the time to do this, because we are recording during the workday. So that's fantastic. And if you want jobs, send us messages. There may or may not be jobs open at any of our companies. But have a great day, everybody. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.